Let me ask you something about your team meetings. Are they peaceful, predictable, efficient? Does everyone generally land in the same place without too much friction? And does the meeting end on time with a sense that things went well? If so, I want to offer you a question worth sitting with before you take too much comfort in that. What if the peace is not actually peace? What if what you're experiencing in those smooth, agreeable meetings is not alignment, but suppression? Not unity, but avoidance. Because here's the reality that most leaders have not fully reckoned with. The greatest threat to your team is not too much conflict, it's the absence of it. And when conflict is missing from the room, it does not disappear, it relocates. It goes into hallways and text threads and side conversations where it does far more damage than it ever would have if it had been surfaced and addressed directly in the meeting. Today, we're talking about how to bring it into the light and why learning to fight fair is one of the most important skills a leadership team can develop. And it's all right here, right now, and only on the Five Gifts Podcast.
You're listening to the Five Gifts Podcast, a weekly show designed to equip leaders in the Spirit-filled church. I'm Bruce Ritter, and along with my co-host, Charles Russell, we offer insights for leading the local church in the fullest expression of Jesus. If you're interested in learning more about practical theology, the gifts of the Spirit, and spiritual disciplines, this is the show for you. Welcome to the Five Gifts Podcast.
Welcome back to the Five Gifts Podcast. I'm Bruce Ritter, alongside the distinguished Charles Russell, and this is Season 3, Episode 17, and it's part two of our Team Dynamics series. I want to welcome everybody. Charles and I have been this weekend in Dallas, Texas, just outside Dallas, meeting with some intercultural leaders, Brazilian churches, all kinds of Latin American churches, as well as some French-speaking African churches, and some Asian churches. So, Charles, I know this has been an exciting weekend for you. It has been for me.
Yeah, absolutely. It's always great when the body of Christ gets together, and we're always honored and privileged to be able to serve the body of Christ. And we've just had a phenomenal weekend. And on top of that, we're full of brisket and Tex-Mex, and it's been a great weekend all the way around. So, but nevertheless, we're here today on this Monday, and glad that everyone has tuned in. Whether you're listening or viewing, we're glad to have you here on the podcast. That last episode, we began laying the foundation about the greatest barrier to team health is not incompetence or misalignment. It's the sin of invulnerability. And so the instinct to protect image rather than lead with honesty. We made the distinction between predictive trust, which is built on reliability and produces efficiency, and vulnerability-based trust, which is built on genuine safety and produces unity. Then we talked about what it looks like to begin building the deeper kind, starting with the leader going first.
Yeah, and today we're building on that foundation, and really it is a logical next step, because once vulnerability-based trust begins to form with your team, something new becomes possible that just wasn't possible before. And for many leaders, the word for it still creates an involuntary tightening in the chest, and that is conflict. Conflict, not the destructive kind, not personal attacks or back-channel politics, or the kind of tension that fractures relationships and undermines decisions. We're talking about the kind of conflict that healthy teams require in order to function at their best. And that kind surfaces the best thinking, produces genuine clarity, and accelerates rather than slows the team's forward momentum. So this episode is called Mining for Conflict, the Efficiency of Fighting Fair. And I think by the end of it, we want to shift something in how you think about tension on your own team, from something to manage and minimize to something actually to steward and pursue.
So before we can talk about what healthy conflict looks like, I think what we need to do is name what its absence actually produces. Because artificial harmony is one of those misdiagnosed conditions in ministry leadership. And it's far more common than what we, most of us as leaders, realize. There's a lethal quiet of artificial harmony. And so, and really, when we're talking about artificial harmony, it's when a team appears unified on the surface, but underneath there are unspoken disagreements, unaddressed concerns, maybe even some unexpressed reservations that just seem to never make it into the actual meeting. People are filtering, they're holding back. They're saying the thing that keeps the peace rather than the thing that they actually are thinking. And so leaders, particularly leaders who genuinely value unity and have worked hard to build a positive team culture, we often misread this as alignment. The meeting went smoothly. Everyone seemed to agree. No one pushed back significantly. It feels like the team is in a good place. But I think what is actually happening is what we would call avoidance. And avoidance always has a cost. Because the thoughts and concerns that don't get spoken in the room, they don't just disappear. They get spoken somewhere else. In the parking lot after the meeting, in a private text to a trusted colleague, could be in a conversation at home that evening. These are what we're calling back channels of an artificially harmonious team. And these are where the real opinions actually live. So here's why that is so much more destructive than open disagreement. These back channel conversations operate without accountability, without the full information that other team members carry, without any possibility of resolution. So when conflict happens in the room, at minimum, it deals with the issue. It may be uncomfortable. It may take longer than the leader wants, but it's at least engaged. It's addressed. And so when conflict goes underground, now it becomes organizational politics. These competing narratives, fragmented trust, slowly accumulating sense of that what gets said in the meeting is not actually what drives the decisions. So that's the environment that artificial harmony produces over time. And it's far more corrosive than any tension that it was designed to avoid.
Yeah, and Charles, if I could just say, man, avoidance when it comes to issues that people do have passion about, avoidance just drives those conversations underground, and that's where you're really breeding some long-term issues. If I would much rather have those conversations in front of everybody where we can really not duke it out in a negative way, but really begin to bring passion around the issue. Engage that passion in those conversations. So let's talk about what happens when you don't do that. Artificial harmony, if that's the problem, if the absence of conflict is actually a warning sign rather than a sign of health, then what makes genuine productive conflict possible? Because conflict without trust is not healthy disagreement, it's just damage. So let's talk about how trust can create the right kind of conflict. Remember, we spent a long time on the previous episode talking about vulnerability. And this is why everything in this series is going to build sequentially. Vulnerability-based trust is not just a nice feature of a healthy team culture. It really is the prerequisite for conflict that actually moves a team forward than tearing it apart. When trust is present at a genuine level, team members can admit mistakes without those admissions being stored and used against them later. They can ask for help without that need being read as weakness. They can give honest feedback and then receive it without the exchange becoming personal. And all of that is only possible when people have enough relational security to believe that the person across the table is genuinely for them. They're on the team. That disagreement is not rejection that challenges, that challenge is not attack. That honesty is not a liability. So when trust is absent, man, everything changes dynamically. People hesitate to speak because they're calculating risk. They protect themselves in meetings rather than contributing fully. And so any conflict that does not surface feels personal. Or rather, the conflict that does surface feels personal, because without trust, there's no agreed upon baseline that the disagreement is about the issue and not about the person. And once conflict starts feeling personal, it stops being productive and it starts being destructive. So the distinction matters enormously. Without trust, conflict becomes attack. And with trust, rather, conflict can become exploration, a genuine joint inquiry into what's true, what's best for the team, for the company, for the organization, what the mission actually requires. And so the content of the conversation may be equally direct in both cases. The difference is whether the people in the conversations believe they're on the same side. And that's why leaders who want to build the kind of conflict culture that we're describing must invest in trust first. You can't mine for conflict productively on a team where people do not yet feel safe. So the sequence is just not an optional thing. It's a necessary realization.
Absolutely. We've got to build that foundation of trust. And once that foundation's in place, the question becomes structural. Specifically, what does it look like to design the spaces where healthy conflict can happen? One of the most practical places to start is with something every leadership team does every week, and that is meetings. Now, if you cringed like I just cringed when I said that word meetings, that's all right. We understand most meetings are not engaging. Most leaders know this, and most team members know this as well. And yet, the format persists week after week. Status updates, announcements, decisions that could have been emails, a polite sense of agreement, and then everybody goes back to their actual work. Well, here's a question worth asking. Why will a person sit completely absorbed in a two-hour movie but struggle to stay present through a 45-minute staff meeting? Well, I think the answer is not that movies are inherently more interesting than leadership decisions. I think the answer is that movies have conflict. They have tension. They have competing interests. There's stakes. There's uncertainty about how things will resolve. The outcome is not predetermined. Something is genuinely at risk, and that's what makes the story worth following. Now look, meetings can have all of those same qualities if the leader is willing to introduce them. A meeting where the outcome is predetermined, where everybody knows that disagreement will be subtly discouraged, where the agenda is designed to move through items rather than genuinely wrestle with them, that's not a meeting, that's performance. And teams learn very quickly whether they're attending a real conversation or a performance, and they calibrate their engagement accordingly. So for us as leaders, the implication then is that our role in a meeting is not primarily to maintain order or even move through the agenda. Our role is to create the conditions for genuine engagement, including the discomfort that genuine engagement sometimes produces. Not chaos, not unstructured venting, but real tension around real questions that are sustained long enough to produce real clarity. That's a word, conflict or even tension, that makes us uncomfortable, but tension is necessary. We navigate, we live in the moment of tension. Look, our bodies function because of tension, and so good healthy conflict, navigating the real tension, the palpable tension sometimes that conflict can bring. Navigating those things are healthy in building trust and in building our teams.
Charles, what a great statement, especially about meetings. And I know that a lot of times we think of teamwork happening outside the meeting room, but honestly, that meeting room is like the huddle for your team. It's the place where you You bring things together. It's so vital. And that means that the leader has to adopt a posture in meetings that sometimes is almost counterintuitive, where you're not functioning as a peacekeeper. And let me say this too, not a timekeeper either, but what we might call a miner, someone who's actively looking for the conflict that's not yet in the room. So how does the leader do that? A healthy leader doesn't wait for the conflict to surface on its own. They look for it. They're specifically watching the room for the signals that something is being held back. The person who's gone quiet, that slight hesitation before someone agrees, like a nonverbal flicker of disagreement that passes across someone's face and then disappears. Leader, pay attention. These are not minor details. They are the indicators that the real conversation hasn't happened yet. And the leader's job is to draw it out, to name what they observed and create permission for what it represents. You might say, listen, I noticed some hesitation when we landed on that decision. Is there something we haven't fully worked through? Or you might say, it feels like we reached agreement quickly on this one, but let's test it. Does anyone have a real concern they haven't voiced yet? Now, leader, these are not provocations, they're invitations. And it's a real coach approach to leadership that really mines out all issues that need to be talked about around most of your leadership decisions. They communicate that honesty is not just tolerated, but it's expected. And that the leader would rather surface a real disagreement now than discover it was there all along after the decision has been made. So there are about two disciplines that leaders have to hold simultaneously. The first is surfacing the issue. That's simply being willing to name what's present, even when naming it introduces discomfort. The second, and the one most leaders struggle with, is sustaining the tension long enough for genuine resolution. Really, the instinct when conflict emerges is to what? Let's resolve it quickly. Let's put the fire out, to find the compromise, to smooth the friction, and move forward. But resolution that comes too quickly is often not resolution at all. It's the appearance of resolution. It's the appearance of unity, with the underlying disagreement still intact. And so if you do not stay in the discomfort long enough for people to actually work through what divides them, you've not resolved the conflict, you've simply postponed it.
So now, mining for conflict only works if you know the difference between the kind of conflict you want and the kind that has to be shut down immediately. Because, look, not all conflict serves the team. The conflict that healthy teams need is ideological conflict. It's passionate, it's honest. Sometimes emotionally engaged disagreement about ideas, directions, priorities, even decisions. And so it's focused on the mission. It can be direct and even intense without being personal. The people in it genuinely respect one another and are genuinely trying to find the best answer, even when they disagree strongly about what that answer is. So the conflict that destroys teams is personal attack. That's when the disagreement shifts from the issue to the individual. Now sarcasm is directed at a person rather than an idea, undermining someone's credibility as a way of dismissing their position. Character-based criticism that goes far beyond the decision at hand to say something about who someone fundamentally is. This kind of conflict does not clarify, it damages. It erodes the trust that makes productive disagreement possible, and then it creates an environment where people are far less willing to engage honestly the next time. So the leader's role is not to prevent all conflict from happening. It's to actively guard the type of conflict that's happening. When ideological conflict is present, the leader sustains it, stewards it toward resolution. When personal attack enters the room, the leader names it and redirects it firmly and immediately back to the actual issue. This is not a passive role. It requires attentiveness and the willingness to intervene in real time, which means the leader has to be genuinely present in meetings rather than managing them from a distance.
Well, Charles, that's exactly a crucial point I think you're making about leadership. Staying engaged and monitoring that's your role. And so I think that's also a great place to demonstrate, the kind of team culture you want to build by allowing it, but also protecting from personal attack. Listen, here's the payoff that makes all of this worth the investment. Because one of the most prominent myths about conflict is that it slows things down. And the reality is almost exactly the opposite. Most leaders avoid conflict because they believe, consciously or not, that engaging it costs more time and more energy than it's worth. And in the short term, that can feel true. I mean, a meeting where disagreement gets surfaced and works through does take longer than a meeting where everyone politely agrees and moves on. But here is what avoidance actually costs. Every unresolved disagreement leaves a meeting still unresolved because it has become a landmine. It sits beneath the surface of the team's work. It's invisible until circumstances raise the stakes enough to detonate it. And detonation at high stakes is exponentially more costly in time, in relational damage, in the quality of the decision ultimately made. And the original disagreement, it could have, if we talked about it more, if we worked through some of the conflict around it, if we addressed it, then we minimize that later on. And when conflict engaged early and honestly happens, then the team gains three things that matter. The first is buy-in. Listen, when people have genuinely had the opportunity to be heard, when their concerns were not just acknowledged but actually wrestled with, they tend to commit to the outcome even when it's not the outcome they advocated for. They lost the argument, but they were in the argument, and that is enough to produce genuine ownership. The second is clarity. Conflict removes ambiguity. It surfaces the assumptions and concepts that were previously invisible. It allows people to voice their concerns rather than keep it under the surface, only to fester and erupt at a later time. And I think it forces precision about what's actually being decided and why. And then the third result is speed, because a team that has genuinely worked through a disagreement and reached a committed decision moves faster than a team that's reached an apparent consensus but is still quietly harboring disagreement underneath it. And this is the principle of disagree and commit. You don't need everyone to agree, but you do need everyone to commit. And commitment follows from a process that was genuine, where people actually were heard, where the disagreement was actually engaged. And then when the decision was actually made rather than deferred, when that process is present, the team can move together with real momentum. When it's absent, you get the illusion of movement while the unresolved conflict is creating that tension underneath that's actually working against it.
Well, there's one more dynamic that has to be addressed, because even teams that have built trust and learned to engage conflict productively can get pulled off mission by something more subtle, and that'd be the drift from mission focus towards self-interest. Organizational politics happen when people prioritize perception over truth, when protecting their area, their position, or their reputation becomes more important than the actual mission of the organization. And it's not always cynical. It can emerge from genuine care about a department or a ministry area, from a sincere belief that what you're responsible for is critical to the whole. But when departmental loyalty consistently overrides team loyalty, the result is a leadership team that's pulling in multiple directions simultaneously with no shared center of gravity. So healthy teams operate from what we call a first team mentality. Your primary loyalty is not to the area you lead, it's to the leadership team and the mission that leadership team exists to serve, which means that sometimes you advocate against your own area for the good of the whole. Well, that just doesn't make sense. That doesn't sound right. But again, we're talking about moving to this, making this shift to a first team mentality. Your ministry doesn't exist for itself. It exists to lift the entire church, to accomplish the vision of the organization. Sometimes the budget decision that's best for the overall mission is not the budget decision that benefits your ministry. And so sometimes the strategic direction that is right for the church requires your team to carry more than its proportional share of the load. A first team mentality says, I'm here to serve the mission, I'm not here to protect my territory. And so keeping that orientation requires clarity about what the mission actually is and what success actually looks like. When teams have a clearly defined scoreboard, things like specific, measurable, agreed upon indicators of whether the work is producing what it's supposed to produce, then ego has less room to operate, because the question is no longer what serves my interest, but what moves the numbers that actually matter. That kind of clarity, it doesn't eliminate politics completely, but it does create an objective reference point that pulls the conversation back toward mission whenever it starts to drift.
Boy, Charles, this is the last segment on getting, you know, from the political environment to a really missional team. I think that's worth probably the whole episode right there. Let me see if I can bring this to a practical landing for this week. There's three starting points that I'd like to leave with our listeners. The first is give real-time permission for conflict in your next meeting. Begin to work with it. When tension surfaces, it name it, normalize it, and keep it going rather than resolving it prematurely. Communicate through your actions that honest disagreement is not a threat to you. It's not a threat to the room. It's what the room is for. It's what the meeting is scheduled for. Secondly, practice what we call cascading clarity at the end of every meeting. Before people leave, define clearly what was actually decided, what remains open, and what gets communicated to whom. This simple discipline prevents a significant amount of the ambiguity that generates a lot of the back-channeling conversations once the meeting's over. Thirdly, start mining. If your next meeting feels too smooth, that if it ends without any real tension having been engaged, please don't call that a success. Ask the harder questions. Invite the disagreement that is almost certainly present in the room but hasn't been voiced yet, because healthy teams don't produce smooth meetings. They produce honest meetings.
Yeah, what a great reminder about beginning to mine conflict. So next week's episode is 15 tactics to pick a fight in your next staff meeting. So we're going to help you out right there. I'm just kidding. Bad joke. Look, here's the question to carry this week. Where is artificial harmony keeping your team from the breakthrough it actually needs? Where are the real conversations happening after the meeting rather than in it? And then what would it look like for you to mine for that conflict rather than continuing to work around it? Because here's what we believe. The teams that move furthest and fastest are not the ones that avoid tension. They're the ones that have learned how to steward tension, how to bring it into the room, how to work through it honestly, and then come out on the other side more aligned than they were going in. If this is an area where your leadership team needs help, if you want to build the kind of conflict culture we've been describing, and you're not sure where to start, connect with us at charlesrusselltraining.com, charlesrussellministries.com, coachingcardia.com. We offer leadership coaching, team development for leaders who want to build something that functions the way it was designed to. So look, next episode, we continue this, the team dynamic series. We're going to get into what happens when teams move beyond trust and healthy conflict into genuine collective accountability. It's one of the rarest dynamics in ministry leadership, and it may be the most powerful. So until next time, we'll see you right here on the Five Gifts Podcast.
You've been listening to the Five Gifts Podcast. If you would like to take the next step as a spiritual leader, we invite you to visit either of our websites or contact us for leadership coaching. We can help you reach the next level in your own growth and leadership. We provide leadership, spiritual gift, and personality assessments that give you a better grasp of your leadership style. And we also create a customized growth plan that empowers you to reach your full kingdom potential. We can't wait to hear from you.